Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 2 minutes after 9 a.m. on the 26th of January 2010. Joining me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Huggins, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, and Senator Egan. We have a full committee and we have a quorum. I'd like to welcome everybody to our first meeting of the Finance Committee of this session, and we'll be running on a normal schedule for the first few weeks, and then we'll start heading into the abnormal as the session goes on and accelerating the meetings to probably daily at the end. I'd like to start off this year. Is a standard practice, we're going to go ahead and review the state's fiscal position. We'll start with the revenue and oil production forecast for the current, the next fiscal year. We'll also look back over a couple. We'll have this subject before us several times over the next 80-some days as we take a look at our budget process, our capital process, and then also just the health of the state. We're going to also spend some time dealing with and looking at long-term trends, both in the past that got us here today and what we expect over the next several years. For the next 3 days this week, today we're going to start with Commissioner Galvin. He's the Commissioner of Revenue and his team. Tomorrow we're going to move on with the OMB Director, Ms. Karen Rayfield, and we're going to take a look at the FY11 budget. And then Thursday, we're going to hear from Ledge Finance and take a look at any modifications that they suggest and their interpretation of the budget. But today we have, for the first time, we have a new member at the committee. We have with us Senator Dennis Egan from Juneau. And welcome, Senator Egan. Although you've been at a few meetings up north in Fairbanks, this will be your first meeting officially sitting here at the table. So welcome, Senator Egan. I'd like to also go ahead and take a look at some introductions or do some brief introductions of the Finance Committee support staff. They're the group that we're all familiar with, but the people at home don't see them very often because they're kind of off camera, but without them, our process here wouldn't run as smooth and as orderly as it does. And with that, I'd like to have Luann Christen come forward. And she is in charge of the operation. I'd like to go ahead and have her introduce her team.
Hi, we have Nancy Jones and Johanna Crossett, our secretarial staff.
Maybe raise your hand or smile so they know who you are.
Nancy, Johanna. And then we are sharing our page with the House, so Marta will be here in the mornings. Marta Listufka, and Allison Holtkamp will be here in the afternoon. So I'm Luann Christen. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. We have some physical changes around the room, as those of us that are here quite often can see. We had relocated the old clock that I used to always watch and time presenters and the flow of the meeting, but that has been relocated. It's an old railroad clock. It was a time clock. Some part of the timing devices have been removed. We thought it fit nice in the room, and we had that sent south and had it fixed. So, you know, I think as a policy, we'll never run longer than the clock, but I just want to remind you the clock is wound once every 7 days. So, hopefully we won't run the clock out. We also have a few new pieces of artwork, original artwork, that we have obtained the legislature. The one behind me is Arctic Madonna, and it is Ziegler, who was born in 1881 and died in 69. And he was an Alaska missionary who traveled our state finding subjects for paintings. He power down that overhead?
Did it redirect it?
Did it comp, too comp? messed up?
Might lose it.
Okay. Well, we'll look at it tomorrow.
You might get a black screen.
Anyway, it's behind there. The other item, another one is on my left, on your right, and it is a Sitka in 1886 by Cleveland Rockwell. He passed away in 1907. He worked for the U.S. Geodetic Survey and conducted survey expeditions in Alaska. And what we have been doing is working with the State Museum curator, and we're doing a multi-year effort to go around the country and find original artwork that belongs in Alaska and bring it back to Alaska. That are, a lot of these items are held by individual private collections, and what we don't want to do is have them disappear out of our state and never to return. So we've engaged the museum curator, who knows art a lot more than anybody at the table here, so to make sure we pay not only fair value, but we get originals and we get the quality pieces. So over the next year or so, you'll probably see a few more pieces appear in the legislature. And we're trying to just give the place a little more flavor of the history of the state. I'd also like to take a couple minutes and just remind everybody the flow of the meetings, because it's been a while, that this committee is a little different from the other committees. Some would say it's a little more structured, but I think it is still fairly comfortable work process to flow with. We'll have our standard presentations, and then when we have our questions, I'll go ahead and just signal me. I'll go ahead and call on you by order who flags first, and try to keep it to one question and then a follow-up. In particular, when we have an item, I know that there's going to be a lot of questions around the table to try to get to all the senators so they can all ask the question, because your second or third or fourth question may be one that your colleague across the table has also. And then when we're done, we'll come back and stay with whoever has questions until we either exhaust our questions, or if we're running too late, we'll have the particular presenter get with yourself and your office and go through your issues, and then we'll bring it back to the table. It's the same standard flow. Sometimes we don't quite stick to the one question if the item is more of interest, or one or two of the senators than all of them. And I'd like to remind everybody, as we go through that flow, that we're going to allow the senators to ask all the questions that they want to ask. On occasion, we're a deliberative body, and as long as it's not a tactical maneuver to stall and do those types of measures, we're going to stick to that. And if we deviate from that, then I'll get with the individual and we'll huddle up and figure how we can keep a smooth process and make sure everybody's views are represented at the table. I'd also like to remind everybody that we don't appreciate cell phones, iPhones, ringing and buzzing and conversations in the room. And the individual presenters have a limited amount of time here to make their presentation, and they keep it focused, and we try to keep them focused. So we want to not miss what they're saying. Sometimes we get one shot at the information, and that also includes distractions such as newspapers and magazines. There's ample enough reading material just on the subject matters that we have before us, that if you have time to read magazines and newspapers at the finance table, then you need to come talk to me, and I need to gear up the amount of volume coming at us, because obviously it's not enough. And then if you're having a little sugar imbalance, or we've been at it a little too long, particularly later on in the session, and you would like a break, just kind of signal me and we'll take an at-ease. We can take at-ease as long as need be, if we need a dinner break or a lunch break, things like that. And if we go into a multi-hour workload, which is the normal process at the end of session, I'll try to have a break every hour or so, a stand-up for 5 minutes or something, so we can try to stay attentive so the information that's delivered is recognized and remembered. I'd also like to introduce Mr. Teal that sits behind me. He works for Ledge Finance. They're a nonpartisan body that'll be doing a lot of work with us and projections and analysis. And as you know, they work for the committee. So if you have questions or concerns, I want him to look at something, ask him. The co-chair and myself like to be kind of in the loop of the workload of that's being requested on him. The information is shared with, you know, with other committee members. One thing we don't want to have is partial information on the table. It doesn't lead to the optimum solution and decision. So we want more information than less. And I just want to remind people at home that we do have a nonpartisan, just like the federal government, group that helps us with the financing. And then we can discuss it and then set the policy direction of the state from there. With that, I'd like to go ahead and fire off today. We have us at the head of the, or at the end of the table, the other head of the table, Mr. Patrick Galvin, who's the commissioner of the Department of Revenue, where our funds come from. And I've asked Commissioner Galvin to come forward today, present his revenue forecast. For those of you at home, we have somewhere I had here a minute ago. Would you hold up your revenue forecast book, Senator Hoffman, for the folks at home? There is a revenue forecast book that's available digitally online at State of Alaska Department of Revenue. I think it's a revenue. You can do your search on Google. You can go back several years. There's a lot of information in it for those of you at home that want to take a look at this for evening reading and want to clear up some sleep issues, you can have at it. Some of us find it kind of exciting and look forward to it presented twice a year. Let's go ahead and read through it. And they change it. I'd like to just remind everybody home, they do change it every year. There's different sections of in it that are emphasized. So by going back two or three years, you get a pretty good review. And for the newest member at the table, I'd like to encourage him to take the time to read through that. There's the revenue source book, and then we'll get into the CAFR, the accounting statements, which has a lot of information in it, although some people find that a little dry too, but it is very, very helpful. With that, Commissioner Galvin, I'd like you to go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and take us through your presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Galvin, Commissioner, Department of Revenue. And I appreciate the opportunity to present to you today the fall 2009 revenue projection. With me, I have a number of the staff members who have been the ones who actually put this together, who do the work day in and day out. First, I'll just introduce a couple of the team leads behind me. You'll see Deputy Commissioner Jerry Burnett. He doesn't have anything particular to present, but he's available to answer questions, particularly as it relates to any of the investment funds. He's the deputy commissioner in charge of the treasury side of the department. Also on the phone is Deputy Commissioner Marcia Davis, who is responsible for the tax side. And she's got a team that works on the various revenue-generating taxes. And she has a couple folks in Anchorage who will also be presenting or available to answer questions, and I'll introduce them as we get to their parts of the presentation. The structure of today's presentation, as you see from the outline, is to initially go through at a fairly high level the revenue forecast for 2010, the current fiscal year, and 2011. These were both updated as part of the fall 2009 revenue forecast. We'll talk about the various parts of it, again, at a fairly high level. Oops. Then I'll just present to you one slide that shows a depiction of a 10-year spending profile and revenue profile. It's based upon the current projected revenue projection and just a single spending plan. You'll get the chance to see that.
Mr. Commissioner?
Yes.
If we could just pause for a second. For those of you at home that have watched a similar presentation, in the other bodies, Finance Committee. We've dazzled it up a little bit over at Senate Finance. We've changed it, and stay tuned. You'll see a little flavor change, and it won't be a repeat. Additional information.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and actually that's the next section. At the request of the Chair, we've gone into detail with regard to how the production tax is calculated, and you'll see the various component parts as they build up, and we'll get into a little bit more detail than we have in other bodies with regard to how the production tax is calculated in the various parts of it. And then we'll finish up with a more in-depth demonstration of how we have generated the production forecast, the oil price forecast, and the lease expenditure projections, and basically how those are generated and the different types of information that's available to us now as a result of having a net-based tax than what we had previously when we were dealing basically with only publicly published information. We now have a different window into the spending plans of the companies that we're able to present, and we'll get to that at the end. So turning first to the fall 2009 revenue forecast. Just want to point out a few particular items of the way that the Department of Revenue presents the state's revenue forecast and the different parts and pieces of that. The primary distinction that we make in the revenue of the state is between unrestricted revenue and restricted revenue. Those terms are used to designate under restricted revenue those funds that are generally set aside either by constitutional requirement or by general practice within the legislature that are not part of what is generally considered to be the general fund. And that is the general fund, as it is kind of commonly used, is a rough equivalent of what we refer to as the unrestricted revenue of the state. That's broken down between oil and non-oil revenue, and also investment earnings. And as you can see from the slide here, the state's projecting, or the Department of Revenue is projecting, an increase in unrestricted revenue between FY 2010 and FY 2011. And the total revenue is also looking at a slight increase between the 2 years. Moving into the unrestricted revenue section, this slide shows you the breakdown between the oil revenue and the non-oil revenue. And as you can see, oil revenue continues to greatly dominate the unrestricted revenue piece of the revenue pie, with total oil revenue constituting between 87 and almost 89% between the 2 years of total unrestricted revenue. The other thing I'll point out is that, as we've seen in the last couple of years, the production tax portion of oil revenue is the dominant portion of the oil revenue, having taken over from previously where the royalty had been a higher level a number of years ago.
Could we, just a second, Senator Hubman. Could we, when you do it, Commissioner Galvin, could you, for those people at home that haven't seen these slides and are wandering around trying to figure out, you know, what you're talking about, could you, you know, call out the line in the numeric?
I'll use this little, try this little hand here and see if I can use this to highlight the portions that I'm referring to.
Because we're looking at oil revenue at $4.6 billion, which is two columns over, $4.4647 billion.
Right, for FY 2011.
To $589 million in all other revenue sources, non-oil revenue.
Correct.
That's the differentiation between the two in magnitude that I think it's important for people to recognize. We can take a reduction in non-oil revenue of 20% without a hiccup, but if we have that on our revenue side, our oil side, we've got a challenge. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Although the total oil revenues are up by about $500 million. Does this number indicate that we are pumping more oil through the pipeline, or is that just as a result of higher oil prices?
Senator Hoffman, you'll see in subsequent slides that it's a result of higher oil prices. We're projecting a decline in production between 2010 and 2011.
Go ahead and continue.
Now turning to the non-oil revenue, as the chairman noted, this is a small portion of the overall unrestricted revenue, and just showing a breakdown between the various sources. Corporate income tax reflected here is the income tax from non-oil based companies, includes mining and fishing and other interests, but is the corporate income portion of the non-oil revenue. Moving on to the 10-year look.
Can we back up just for a minute?
Sure.
Just to kind of put this in context for those, you've got 298.8, right under 300 million in other taxes, but what was the revenue per month in our highest month generated on the oil side?
Just in FY 2009, the highest was almost $1 billion in a month.
And currently, what would you, you know, if you just had to guess what last month was as a benchmark?
Roughly, probably 300 million.
So we're basically making today, in 1 month, what we collect in a year off all the other taxes of corporate, mining, insurance, tobacco, motor fuel.
That's correct. In all oil revenue sources, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Galvin, as you look at the non-oil revenue detail, you look at mining and we're dropped down by $1 million. What's the reason for that? You would expect that to go up because of the world demand for minerals that are out there. And
well, now that you're drilling into one particular aspect, maybe I'll take advantage of it and bring up one of our economists who work on the specific portions.
Mr. Chairman, it's going to take too long. We can talk about it later.
He's sitting right here, and actually he's going to be presenting in a little bit. Dan, do you want to come up? So, Mr. Chair, this is Dan Stickle. He's a petroleum economist within the department here in Juneau, but he previously had worked in the non-petroleum section, and he can speak to this issue, and we've got other folks on the line who can go into greater detail if we get into it in a later question.
If you can introduce yourself for the record first.
Sure. For the record, my name is Dan Stickle. I'm a petroleum economist with the Department of Revenue, and I believe the moderate decline in fiscal 11 in regards to mining is due to the effects of somewhat lower minerals prices in our projection.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and continue, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So turning to the 10-year outlook, this slide is one that we use just as an illustration of a comparison of our current revenue projection and an extrapolation of current spending at a very modest level of increase on an annual basis. It's a 3% budget escalation from 2011 forward. That I would consider to be an extremely conservative number. And it's reflected here in showing that surplus is growing as we move into the mid part of the upcoming decade. As a result of this projection, as you see from some of the fine print at the bottom, it's hard to read on the slide, but at the end of this period, if this behavior were to be pursued, we end up with a balance in the Constitutional Budget Reserve of almost $24 billion.
Well, let's define for those at home what the Constitutional Budget Reserve is and what we have.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Constitutional Budget Reserve is a fund set up by the state constitution to designate funds that would be used for budgetary purposes in future years. It was designed to hold surplus dollars to be available when the state needed them at times of shortfall. The requirement for accessing the Constitutional Budget Reserve is a higher level. The legislature would need a three-quarter vote in order to access the CBR, and it is intended to be used to smooth the state's fiscal picture, given the vagaries of the market and the fluctuations that we experience with our revenue.
So this is the state savings account. We don't go for those, you know, at home. You know, we don't go to the permanent fund to finance our shortfalls. We go to the budget reserve accounts, both statutory, which is simple majority vote, and then the constitutional budget reserve.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We have a number of different funds. The constitutional budget reserve is, you know, within the scale of things, it's sort of the mid-range in terms of the protection from the public's perspective, with the permanent fund being the one that's the most protected. Then the constitutional budget reserve is available to the legislature as needed with a three-quarter vote. The statutory budget reserve is one set up by the legislature, as you indicated, that is available through a majority vote, but it is also a reserve account to be used at times of shortfall otherwise.
And currently we have $10 billion in there roughly for off your chart on FY10, the end of this fiscal year is your target?
Between the various reserve accounts, $10 billion, yes.
And then if I could I'll just get you in just in a minute, Senator Hoffman. When we go forward to 2017, you're showing a $20 billion balance?
That is correct, given the assumptions that went into this model.
Okay. Senator Hoffman?
And with this model, Mr. Chairman, through 2020, you don't anticipate any draws from the CBR to balance the state's budget, just the statutory budget reserve draw.
Mr. Chair, given the very modest spending increases, it would not project to need a draw on the CBR given the current revenue projections.
And if I could just add a little bit just for those at home, I think the title shows a 3% budget escalation. So I recall under a couple of governors ago, they were showing us revenue, our budget projections close to zero. And 3%, I think are embedded, and when we get into Senator Hoffman's challenge with the operating budget, the formula-driven side of our operating account is somewhere substantially higher than that, where our portion of the operating budget that we have some control over, at least under this year's proposal, is a little under 3, but when you add them together, it's substantially over that, at, I think 5.8. So we'll spend quite a bit of time here at the table looking at that particular issue, what we actually have control over and what we don't. And to get to 3%, the stuff we have control over would have to be running negative, which I think is going to be problematic to some areas of the state. So we've got some challenges. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Galvin, I just want to make sure that I'm reading this chart right. If you look under FY11 up there, you're looking at the budget surplus, the difference between $5.2 billion and $4.7 billion. Shouldn't that number be, or am I reading it wrong, that the number should be $494 million as opposed to $94 million that's up on the chart? Is that correct? Under column.
Yeah, I understand. I'm looking at it myself.
If you subtract the two, I come with $494
million. What column are you looking at?
Yeah.
FY11.
If you look in the footnotes,
okay,
you'll see that for FY11, one of the assumptions that was made was $400 million was set aside for the governor's scholarship program.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for pointing that out.
Just so people don't get the wrong impression of what we're looking at here, these are hypothetical forecasts running at 3%, which is historic inflation. It is what it is, but whatever happens in the future is going to be different than this. Could be higher, could be lower. I hope we have $20 billion in 2017, but in budgetary reserves, but most likely not.
Mr. Chair, I would wholeheartedly agree with you that this is one reflection of a scenario that is unlikely to occur for a variety of reasons, but it is simply for illustrative purposes to show the relationship between the revenue projections going out 10 years and the current spending levels.
And then if you could briefly touch on the operating side, touch on the capital side embedded in your chart.
Yeah, the capital assumptions in here are extremely modest, taking the capital budget from last year, which was historically low, and extrapolating that out forward.
Right. And just to remind folks at home, last year the Finance Committee took extraordinary action in reducing capital outlays due to the implosion in the financial markets and the decline in oil prices. And hopefully, you know, that what's coming in the future will be nothing like what we went through the last couple of years. So those are also very, very conservative on the lower end estimates. Okay, go ahead and continue.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So now we're going to get into details with regard to the production tax and how it is calculated and generated. This is, again, a very, in order to bring it down to one page, we've kind of simplified some aspects of it. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the areas where we've had to take some measures in order to be able to reflect it here on this single page. But the intent of this display is to show you the various component parts of the production tax calculation, how they relate to each other, and basically how you get from a total revenue generated by our oil production, which is this $17.2 billion for FY 2009, and have it result in our amount of production tax. So walking our way through, the first thing you'll note is that we do not include royalty, or what's referred to as royalty or federal barrels, in our production tax calculation. The royalty barrels are those that are basically owned by the state as part of our lease contract, and we do not apply a production tax against the royalty barrels, so those are deducted off the top, as well as any barrels. When we say federal barrels, and this is also an important distinction, we're referring to those that are basically offshore, outside of the state of Alaska. Production that's within the state on federal land still is required to pay the production tax.
So the first thing that comes off the top is royalties.
Correct. Royalties are taken out.
And that's 12.5% of the barrels, and where does the money go?
It's roughly 12.5%, depending on the leases. That's sort of the general rule. You use 12.5% because that's the largest production areas. A quarter of that will go into the permanent fund. The remainder comes into unrestricted revenue.
So that's an important point for everybody at home to remember, that a quarter of the royalty share goes directly to the permanent fund. There's some portion of that that goes to schools and some other things, but what I've tried to do with the commissioner is lay this out, and we're gonna add on this over the next couple of months. But it's important as we go through it for not only the public, but for the members of the table, when we have an issue at the table, that is mentally plug in the calculation what area we're talking about. Otherwise, it'll get confusing, especially when we get into credits and other embedded items. But go ahead and continue.
So that brings us down to what we refer to as our taxable barrels. And that basically was worth almost $15 billion once you subtract out the royalty and federal barrels. One way to look at this is the value of our oil at its ultimate market, basically the refinery where it goes into the process. In order to get the taxable value, we have to make some deductions. The first of which are what are referred to as downstream transportation and other deductions that are used. The downstream is a reference to a point of production that we designate. We're basically pump station one, if you want to visualize it, at the top of the Trans-Alaska pipeline. Those costs that are incurred to get the product to market downstream of that point are deductible. On this slide, we've broken it down into a couple of the component parts. The marine transport, this is the cost to run the oil tankers out of Valdez. The TAPS tariff, the amount that's charged in order to ship your oil down the pipeline. The other is a hodgepodge of different both expenditures and credits. The primary credit being what's referred to as quality bank. Depending on the nature of the oil that you are producing, you're going to get a different valuation through the transportation system. And to try to simplify a very complicated issue, just recognize that there is a truing up of the value of your oil as it goes through that process. And that value is captured here in the referred to as other category, because it is the net of a number of different component parts that are relatively small but are, at the end of the day, valuable either to the state or to the producer in capturing for the purposes of calculating the production tax. The $6.48, $6.50 is what you can generally just refer to as the transportation cost deduction for production tax purposes. Amounts to about $1.4 billion of total value. Just taking a slight break here, you'll hear the term, the value at the point of production, as a term that's thrown around a bit in the oil tax discussion. That would be the net of these two numbers. If you take the $14.9 billion, subtract the $1.4, so about $13.5 billion is the total value of our oil at its point of production. Turning next to what are deductible upstream costs. So again, upstream of the point of production, we allow, for production tax purposes, deductions associated with the cost to produce the oil. Those are broken into two different categories, operating expenditures and capital expenditures. Generally, operating expenditures are your day-to-day costs associated with running the facilities and keeping the oil moving. Capital expenditures are going to be those costs associated with putting in new equipment, drilling new wells, doing new activities associated with trying to increase or maintain your production.
One of the things, if you could, Mr. Commissioner, touch on, we'll just use operating expenditures. It's $9.39 on your slide, but sometimes, depending on the presenter, it may be net barrels or gross barrels. So can you touch on how that's related into the tariff? Excuse me, not the tariff, but the royalty. Barrels.
Sure. And this is where we get into one of the areas of complication to try to show it on a single page. What we have done in this representation is you start on the right-hand side. The number, the $2 billion number for operating expenditures is the total operating expenditures that were deducted Basically, the oil that resulted in property tax, and we can get into more detail on that in a moment. And in order to get the per barrel amount, we divided that by this 218 million barrels, which is the taxable barrels. The operating costs include the cost of producing royalty barrels. Those operating costs are deductible. But for the purposes of this slide, we have divided the amount by the taxable barrels to provide a per barrel cost for the tax so that it all adds up at the end of the column. And so this number, the 939, may not be the same number you might see from maybe higher than what you would see if a company was showing their operating costs, because they would likely spread those operating costs among all the barrels they produce, including the royalty barrels.
So I think it's important, because it's led to some confusion in the past, you know, when we've worked on the issue. The $2 billion, $50 million is $2 billion, $50 million, regardless if it's gross or net barrels. But what we need to always check when we have different presenters as if they're using gross or net barrels, netting out the royalty barrels. So when we look back at the change, and we've had a lot of discussion on the change of operating and capital costs, and sometimes we've been surprised at the table of the change, and then sometimes we've been a little confused because the presenter will present it one way and another presenter might present it another. So we always need to kind of keep that in mind when we start comparing per barrel costs, because it does lead to some confusion, and we're going to try to keep it standardized for the presentations as we go forward over the next 80-some days. But it is an area that does lead to some confusion.
And then the same would be true on the capital expenditures. The number on the right-hand side is the total capital expenditures for the capital costs that were deducted from the taxes that were paid. And I'll talk a little bit about the other ones that are associated with capital costs, operating costs, that are for companies that don't owe production tax. So that's the missing part of here if you're trying to complete the puzzle with the revenue sources book. So we end up with total lease expenditures, $3.8 billion, approximately $17.40 per barrel to get. And so you deduct, if we're just looking on the per barrel side, and this becomes important on the progressivity calculation, taking the price per barrel, $68.34, and just note that this price, annual price, $68.34, is the average across the entire year. And we'll talk in subsequent slides why that's important. But we're deducting then the transportation costs, deducting the total lease expenditures to get at the production tax value a value of $44.46 per barrel, which equates to $9.7 billion of total taxable value that is then used as the basis for calculating what the tax bill is. So now applying the production tax.
Before we go into there, that's commonly, I think, referred to as total upstream costs, total production costs. Is that correct?
It could be, yeah. There's different terminology that's used for these. In the language of the production tax, we use the word lease expenditure. That's the terminology that's used to designate what is qualified within the definition to be deductible for the purposes of calculating your production tax.
And it does get confusing because some presenters will use different terms. So we're going to try to keep that standardized. We're learned that through the School of Hard Knocks here at the table the last several years.
So now turning to the actual calculation of the production tax. So we take the $9.7 billion, and first off, you look at the base tax. 25% is the base tax rate. That results in a little over $2.4 billion of the base tax. Then you turn to the progressivity aspect of the tax. And here we've included a little formula to show you how that progressive tax component is calculated. So you take the $44.46, that is the per barrel value, subtract $30, which is the starting point for progressivity, results in about $14.46, and multiply that by 0.4%. And the result is about 5.8%. So that 5.8% is then taken against the $9.7 billion, and we get the progressive tax of about a little over half $1 billion, which results in a total tax due before credits of just under $3 billion.
And then if we were to get the tax bite before credits, we would just add 25 and 5 and 5.8, 30.8, if we want to put progressivity on top of production or the base tax.
The total average tax rate in this demonstration would be 30.8%.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the last piece is to then allow for the deduction of the credits that were earned against the tax bill. In 2009, the total credits that were deducted were about $350 million, which results in a total calculation of $2.6 billion for production tax purposes.
And maybe briefly explain the credit, what it is, where it goes, and there's a little 30-cent deal in there and a few other little things. So, and again, this is a stripped-down model, and I asked the commissioner to boil this down and spread it out into three tables, because as we come forward, we're going to build on it, and there'll be several more pages. But we want to put this together in pieces, so
this
is going to get complicated later on.
This line is fairly dense with additional information that's behind the scenes. For those who would be just looking at this slide, one mistake they might make is to say, okay, well, I know that capital expenditures earn a 20% credit. If you take 20% of the $1.75 billion, it all adds up. That was just coincidence. In reality, the capital credits that are earned I'll do a brief introduction to this because it's going to be something that will drive you crazy. The language of production tax, the capital credits that are designated through this line item are predominantly what are referred to as 023 credits. And that's a reference to the section of the tax code where we provide for all capital costs associated with production, you're able to get a 20% credit. That 20% credit currently is available half in the year in which you make the expenditure and the other half in the subsequent calendar year. So this amount of expenditures that were applied in FY 2009 are simply those that are, you know, available to them based upon that split between the two different years. In addition, they may earn credits under what's referred to as 025, which is also known as the Exploration Incentive Credit Program. Under 025 or the EIC program, they could earn either 30% or potentially 40% of their capital expenditures, depending upon whether or not they are either drilling costs or seismic costs, and whether or not they are located far enough from existing operations, existing units, or existing wells in order to qualify for those two programs. It is a, right now, a very a much smaller part of the total credit amount, but it is a component of the credits that will be deducted. And finally,
just for those watching at home on these numbers we throw out, like the 023A, I mean, it's a subsection of 43.55 of our statutes, and we're not cooking up these oddball numbers here at the table in definitions. It just want people at home to know these are referenced to the code, and a lot of times are the statutes, and we'll refer to the major 20% credit as the capital credit, but there's several other components, and as we get into this issue later on, it becomes very important to differentiate exactly what we're talking about and where it's plugged in, because some of these have phased in and phased out over the last 3 or 4 years, and we just need to try to keep them all straight, but just to help with those wild numbers.
And the other, as the chairman noted earlier, with the capital, or with the deductions up here, I'll just leave it general, there is a basically an exclusion, 30 cents per barrel exclusion, associated with the estimated cost of just general maintenance. So those are excluded from being deductible off of your lease expenditure calculation. The final part that I want to note with regard to these credits down here is also included in the credits that would be applied against taxes are those credits that are purchased by a taxpayer from a non-taxpayer who earned the credit. So in other words, if a company does not have a production tax obligation, they don't have production, perhaps they're just a new entrant into the state, they can earn a credit from the state for investing in a drilling campaign or a seismic operation. And those credits, under certain circumstances, can be converted into cash by either bringing them to the state, and the state, under certain circumstances, can pay cash for those, or they can be transferred or sold to a current producer who will buy them at some level and then be able to use them on a dollar-for-dollar basis to deduct them from their current tax bill. And so this $350 million includes certificates that were purchased by our taxpayers from our companies that are investing in the state and earning the credits otherwise.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Galvin, I recall when there was a lot of debate about this particular issue and how it would be dysfunctional and people would get gouged. I mean, what are the true symptoms as you look at it thus far?
We are not privy to the actual negotiations, but we continue to hear from companies who earn the credits that they much prefer a system where they can come to the state and get a cash payment than one where they have to go to an existing taxpayer. They do lose value, and it does result in a time delay in their availability to turn the credit into cash. And so we continue to hear concerns about any barriers that may be put up with regard to the explorer, as it were, being able to convert the credit into cash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That begs the question, is this part of the modification that the governor has proposed in ACES?
Yes. There is a couple components of the governor's proposal that would eliminate a couple of the barriers that currently exist for the explorers being able to get cash from the state for their credits.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And if we could, Mr. Commissioner, back up maybe to the 23A credit, the main 20% capital credit. Do they send you a bill and then you pay it in 30 days, or do they deduct it off the top, or how does that mechanism work?
A current producer would deduct it right off the top, and you can see on this slide we've got credits applied against taxes. So this is just recognizing that a large portion of the credits that are earned will be taken right off of their tax bill, and we'll never see the money, basically. We'll just get a report that will recognize that they earned the credit and deducted it from their tax bill. Others will have to apply to the state for what's called a credit certificate. These are folks that don't have production tax that they owe that they can deduct it against, and they will basically provide the documentation to the state Department of Revenue to have us recognize the credit was earned and provide them with a certificate that is then either you can sell it to an existing producer, or you subsequently bring it back to the state for getting a cash payment under if you meet certain qualifications.
And I think it's important for us to to remember that and always look for that at the table, because the large 20% capital credit by Exxon, BP, and Conoco, we don't really see in a lot of our summary documents. It's already taken off of the revenue side, so we're always struggling with that issue as far as clarity. Are we looking at the total revenue? Are we looking at some adjustments after that? So, there's summary documents and stuff that'll show credits, but a lot of times it is not the capital credit, the main capital credit. It's the credit that impacts our cash flow after some monies have been received by the Treasury, and what monies have to go out and these credits that are put to the Treasury by smaller companies that don't have positive cash flow to consume it themselves. So there's always that clarity issue. So we'll be bringing that subject up from time to time, always trying to recognize what is that credit and how does it impact us. We'll also spend some time going into the capital credit on where it is being generated. Is it maintenance? Is it exploration? Development, is it from Prudhoe Park, Point Thompson? So we have a good idea, as much as we can with public information, a good idea of what we, what we're faced with that credit, because we, concerned about the decline in production, and we want to know what the capital expenditures are going for and the impact it may have on the volume going down the taps. So it's an item that it's an easy oversight to just ignore it because it's not readily apparent a lot of times, but it has a huge impact on our forecasting models and everything else when we sit at the table and we look at capital and operating expenditure expectations and the credit that the capital expenditures will create.
And that's an important point to understand, just to put some dollars on it. This $350 million that you see here is one that's usually just lost in the revenue projection. All you see is usually this bottom number. But the $350 million was taken off because of the credits earned. What you'll also see is $193 million, which were the credits for which the state paid cash to an explorer who earned them. They were earned the same way. They were a result of the exact same types of investments. But the $193 million had to be paid through an appropriation. And so here in the Finance Committee, you will see that appropriation as a line item in the budget, understanding that there was already $350 million that was taken by the companies that pay production tax before the state actually received the money. So total, there was about $540 million in credits that reduced the state's basically spending by that 540, 350 of which were taken above the line, as it were, before we provided you with a number for the budget, and 193 were taken below the line in the form of an appropriation. Okay, so now that I've walked you through and given you a sense of precision as to this particular page, I'm going to blow that out of the water, because as you see at the bottom of the page here, we end up, as a result of all these calculations, which are all accurate numbers, you end up with a total annual production tax of $2.6 billion. But in reality, in FY 2009, we collected $3.1 billion in production tax. So why the difference? This would be a little quiz if we were in a classroom. And the answer is that we calculate production tax on a monthly basis, not on an annual basis. And so if you remember on the slide, I showed you $68 was the annual average price per barrel. And what you see on this slide, and I apologize for the small numbers, but you have the handouts in front of you. For FY 09, it provided a perfect example of what happens with a widely varying monthly oil price. We started in July, the first month of the fiscal year, with an average monthly oil price of $132.87. 6 months later, in December, we had a monthly price of $37.70. Because of the progressivity calculation, what you'll see, and I highlight this on this next slide, is that if you just compare July and December, you'll see that December, the price represented about a 28% of the July price. So $37.70 is about 28% of $132. Yet the production tax that was generated by that oil price was only 5% of the production tax receipts. And that's a function of progressivity. And what that means is you can't just take the average annual oil price and spread it over the year and think that you're going to be able to levelize all the numbers on an annual basis and come up with a calculation that is the actual production tax receipts, because each month is going to vary in the relationship between the price of oil and the production tax that's generated. And so for that reason, as we walk our way through this, both here and in future presentations, we'll try to remind you of some of those complications when you're looking at annual projections versus the different component parts trying to be represented on an annual average basis.
I think also when we look back at ACE or PPT and ACES, and we looked at the progressivity, we didn't really look at a $100 swing in oil, although, you know, we tried to set up our mechanism to deal with it. Clearly, those numbers will tighten up if oil prices were in a band of $10 over a fiscal year versus $100. So this is hopefully an aberration in time. I know sitting at our table at $37 for oil is a little problematic.
But it also reflects, if I may for a moment, just recognize that it reflects the way in which the tax system responds to oil prices. That when oil prices drop dramatically, the tax has a much smaller bite of the profits in order to provide more for the companies to remain profitable during those tight times.
Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Commissioner. That's an excellent point. And could you just point out for the people at home, if you take July and January, and if you took July, and what would roughly your calculation of total government take when you include the federal government and royalties in July versus January? Because there is a substantial difference.
There is a substantial difference. In and I don't have the numbers precise, but if I were just to ballpark, in a $37 world, government take is probably somewhere just short of maybe right around 60%. When you get to $132, it's probably closer to a little over 80%.
Yeah. I mean, that's important for all of us to realize that there is a huge swing involved. Yeah, thank you,
Mr. Chairman. I think as a follow-up, Senator Huggins, when later on we'll have those government take calculations run historically, so we have, this is a good year as an example, high and low. And we can see those numbers move and see how close our forecasts were a couple years ago. And
also just, and this is when we calculate, for example, if we did a government take for FY 2009, it would be significantly different if we did what it would be for an average of $68 over the entire year. In other words, if you took a monthly projection of $68 per month versus the reality that we faced with 132 down to 30. And so that's an important distinction when we get to providing that kind of analysis, that we specify what the underlying assumptions are with regard to monthly prices, because that will be a big swing in the outcome. And I'm not going to walk you through in great detail, just point out we also provide FY 2010.
Hold it a second, because just for those folks at home, I know we spend a lot of time on government take and quickly define it for the people at home when we talk about 60 or 70 or 80% government take. What is it?
It's a number that's used to reflect of the amount of basically the profit available in oil production. So you take out your costs. It's kind of as we see here. If you take out your costs associated with transportation and production, and you look at the sort of net value, how is that distributed between the government and the company? And the government take reflects the percent of that profit that is basically acquired by either the state or federal government. And it can be used as a comparison between different jurisdictions so that you can look at what an equivalent government take may be in other places around the world so that we can compare ourselves to other places.
Okay. Thank you.
So with FY 2010 and FY 2011, we ran the same type of chart, and again, this one suffers from some of the difficulties of annualizing that the previous chart did. And so you'll note what we've done for FY 2010 and 11 is just reflected the difference between the way this sort of annual illustration calculates a total tax, and then we adjusted it based upon those monthly differentials primarily in order to reflect what's actually included in the revenue sources book as our annual projection. And for FY 2010, I'll just note that this contained a few months of actuals because we have actual values because this is the current fiscal year. And we then project our assumptions based upon monthly oil price projections for the remainder of the year. And so we're able to capture that in the production tax forecast. For FY 2011, similar methodology used on this page, and again, an adjustment down here. For FY 2011, because we're looking forward entirely, what we do there is we do quarterly oil price projections. And so we'll have 3 months in blocks, that will reflect those monthly changes so that we can capture what we expect to be the trend in the market and reflect it properly in our overall projection so that we're not basically smoothing away some of the accuracy.
If you could give us just a quick, and there were very similar flows, but the capital credits substantially different, 350, 360, and then 420, 420 being expectations for 11. Can you give us just a brief summary of that item? And I know we're going to go into it in probably excruciating detail here in the next several weeks, but.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So what you see reflected in the progression between FY 09, 10, and 11 is an increasing level of credits applied against the taxes, and that reflects what we project as an increasing spending that we've both experienced already in FY 09 and 10, because, again, as we said, there's a lag from 1 year to the next because of the two-year spread, and basically increasing spending levels result in higher credits.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. But Commissioner Galvin, correct me if I'm wrong, but that there's also that carry forward from the previous year, right? That you can't, you have to spread out your capital expenditure deductions over 2 years. So that's not exact because you're really looking backwards is a portion of that element. What happened in the previous year?
That's correct. What we're seeing is with the increasing levels of spending that we're currently projecting, the impact of that increase is basically lagged by the half a year. So my reference was simply to the fact you are correct that for the credits that are applied in a particular year will reflect half of the value of the expenditure for that year and half what were the expenditure experience of the previous year.
Mr. Chairman, one follow-up.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yep. In a follow-up, I guess my concern is, you know, sitting here representing people in the economy of the state, is it appears that just by the way this is designed, there is, if you use some of these elements as an indicator, in this case, the capital piece, that it's not accurate in the sense it would be a delay in the potential of a reduction in capital expenditures if you just looked at that piece.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, the impact of the expenditure is delayed. However, when we project our capital expenditures, they are reflected in the year in which we expect the actual expenditures to be incurred. And so the credits, which is kind of down in the machinery, the actual deduction of a credit, is a reflection of the previous year and the current year. However, when we are reporting our projection for lease expenditures, that's not lagged. That's just what we expect to be expended in that particular year.
And, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And just to follow up on that, Senator Huggins, I think when we go into the capital credit issue, we'll be taking a look at the fiscal years, and then there's a whole other, you know, little 50% calculation to see when it's going to hit the Treasury. But we're going to spend a lot of time looking at, you know, your exact point, what actually created the capital credit, and is it what we want to encourage or not encourage, or from a policy perspective? And I don't have that answer, but over the next several weeks we'll work on that. But at the bottom of 11 there, and you have something called less adjustments, 199 negative million. Could you briefly touch on that, because that wasn't in 09, I don't think.
Right. That is the reflection of the difference between an annualized calculation where we kind of smooth everything out and the monthly variations. Okay. And so in order to reconcile this annualized treatment that results in the 2.63 that you see down here, to the actual revenue forecast, which is the 2.43, we have to make an adjustment in order to capture, reconcile those two numbers.
That's fine. Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, between 2009 and 2011, the capital expenditures have gone up significantly. Is that because of more wells or?
It's a combination of some new development projects, the capital expenditure bucket includes your new developments. So, for example, the Nikaiachuk project is ramping up. We've got activities going on still at Ugarit as they're getting up to speed. We've got Point Thompson, the wells being drilled out there, and then exploration wells across the board. It will also include seismic programs, and will include major capital replacements. So if you have pipelines being replaced, those would be considered to be within the capital expenditure pile. Maybe anticipating your question, there has been a lot of talk with regard to the amount of maintenance dollars that is being expended, and I asked our folks to be looking at that, and maybe when we get to that part, we can talk about it in more detail. But generally, we are not seeing the increase in spending projections that the companies are providing us to be the result of a disproportionate growth of maintenance costs or maintenance expenditures. It's not reflected in the reports that they're giving us.
Either operating or capital.
Either operating or capital.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank
you. And then the final note, just to recognize somewhat the simplicity of this slide, maybe masking some of the complexity of the application, is that this is a amalgam of all the different companies. Each individual taxpayer is going to be affected by this calculation differently, because although we take these operating and capital expenditures and kind of lump them all together and spread them across all the barrels equally, in reality, the different taxpayers are experiencing different levels of costs. And so while they may be accessing the same market and are generating the same amount of, or a similar amount of, overall revenue, their expenditures, and even in the tariff and other places, they're going to be spending different amounts, that their taxable value on a per barrel basis could be wildly different between two different taxpayers and would result in different calculations of their taxes because of progressivity. And so, again, this is an attempt to simplify things and bring them all into one page, but because of those differences, it is not an accurate depiction of what you ultimately will receive in tax payments. And then finally, the last little bit to hammer that one home is that as a company ramps into production, as they go from being an explorer into being a producer, there'll be a period of time in which they will perhaps waive between having their credits completely eliminate their tax obligations versus having some production tax obligation. And that will primarily be a function of oil prices. And so from the standpoint of trying to project some of these numbers, particularly what level of taxes are going to be applied against, or what level of credits are going to be applied against taxes versus submitted for the generation of a certificate, it becomes a multiple variation or multiple variable calculus that you're trying to project. Okay, for this particular taxpayer, we can expect X amount of credits being generated, and if you take a particular oil price, it may result in an actual production tax being due, which means that all their credits are going to be expended before we would get a tax payment, or it may result in the credits only going to a partial reduction of their taxes due, and they may end up paying his taxes, or they may end up walking in and asking us to give him a certificate for those credits. And any of those scenarios could play out for a particular taxpayer, and so we try to forecast that as best we can. But it means that with changes in oil prices, with changes in expenditure levels, things won't necessarily be linear in terms of their effect on these different columns.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Galvin, Point Thompson, if you take a look at Exxon's development plan and you look at gas and oil, when do you anticipate Exxon going from explorer to producer at Point Thompson?
The short answer is our production forecast, and we'll get into it in details, is 2014. They would begin to move towards production of liquids at Point Thompson. That's our current projection.
Follow up?
Yeah, and just for clarification, when you say liquids, what does that include?
That's basically barrels of oil.
Barrels of oil.
Yeah, right. We'll just leave it there.
Thank you.
Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I recall during the original discussions about ACES, there was concern about maintenance, since you mentioned maintenance, and there was a issue over a fairly large spill at that time that had shut the pipeline down for some period of time, and we've had some others since then. Are you going to, you know, review the impact on the state's revenue from those types of events that take place at some time later, or had you not, or was that something that we would just have to ask that question now and have you at least address that?
Senator Thomas, to the chair, I can take that in so many different directions. I'm trying to figure out which direction to take that question, but in terms of maintenance costs, within ACES, there was a provision that said that you cannot deduct costs associated with unexpected interruptions of service, and that is still being worked out in terms of how we're actually going to define it. But at the end of the day, we expect that, because I think that the testimony was fairly clear, or the legislative record is fairly clear, that it was expected that the costs associated with that particular shutdown event would not be deductible. The question with regard to calculating the impact of the shutdown, there is a lawsuit currently in place where the state is pursuing damages associated with that lost production, and we can provide you with a briefing on the calculation method for how we value those lost barrels separately, if you wish.
That'd be fine with me. Thank you.
We have roughly about 35 minutes, so I'll kind of watch the clock for you, Mr. Commissioner, as we roll through, so you can finish today.
Sure.
I think coming attractions will be less mathematical and more graphical, so the pace will pick up.
And also, I won't have to be the one speaking, so it'll hopefully go a lot faster. So that brings us to the components of the production tax calculation, and this allows us to introduce you to some of the other folks on the team who do the work to provide the production and price forecasting and some of the work in generating the lease expenditure production. And on the phone, we have a couple folks that I'd like to introduce. First is Donna Keppers. She is one of our master auditors that we brought in as a result of the lease or the ACES legislation that allowed us to bring in high-level audit folks who have significant industry experience. We're very pleased to have Donna on board. In addition to her work in the audit section, we've also been utilizing her to provide guidance and leadership with the econ team, given that we currently are still without a chief economist. We've been unable to fill that position for over a year and a half. And so Donna has been providing some guidance in that shop as well. And so I'll have Donna kind of take the lead on these various components, and she'll be introducing you to Frank Molly, who is our contractor, who does our production tax forecasting. And then Dan here, who you've already met, will walk you through the lease expenditure part of the presentation. Okay, so, well, Don, are you there?
Well, we'll give this a try and see how the flow goes. If not, we'll bring it back. I have confidence in the revenue commissioner that he could explain this stuff with his eyes closed. But we'll let him pass the ball, seeing how he's been talking for an hour and a half.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll see. Don, see how this works. Don, are you there?
And yes, I'm here.
And just, Mr. Chair, let me just acknowledge that Donna would have been here, and she intended to be here, but because of a snafu in my travel arrangements, I did not have a ticket on the flight last night, and Donna and I swapped seats on a full flight, and so that's why she's where she is, and I apologize for that. We intended to have everybody here.
Right, and I appreciate that, Commissioner, that you took the extraordinary effort to come to the Friendly Finance Committee and do your presentation, and it's warranted. And I'll go ahead and call on the individuals on the phone so we can kind of keep an orderly chaos as we walk through this, because it is a little cumbersome. But Ms. Kepler, if you can go ahead and identify yourself for the record, welcome to Senate Finance, and go ahead and walk us through slide number 18.
For the record, my name is Donna Keppers, Audit Master for the Department of Revenue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee, for the opportunity to present to you today. We'll be giving you the overview on the components of the oil price forecast, and we're going to cover that with production that will be presented by Mr. Frank Molly. Then we'll circle back around to talk specifically about the price forecast methodology we used, and then we'll wrap up with the lease expenditures presented by Dan Stickle, our petroleum economist. So if I can introduce you first to Mr. Frank Molly, our petroleum engineer.
Okay, Mr. Molly, if you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and tell us the longevity of your position, please, with the state on this.
Yeah, for the record, my name is Frank Molly, and I'm a petroleum engineer, and have worked for the state since, I believe it was last spring. I did some work on Cook Inlet.
Okay, you're just as a note for the record, I don't want to give you a benchmark tip, but your predecessor missed the forecast by just a handful of barrels, and we always look for improvement. So spot on will be just right for us tonight or today. But go ahead and give us your forecast.
Yeah, the graph that you're looking at is a graph of a North Slope production by field from 1978 through 2030. To the left of the vertical blue dotted line is the historical data, and to the right is the forecast data. To generate the forecast, we gathered production data from each well from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission and then applied a trend analysis on the recent history for each well and carried that trend out to generate a per-well forecast. Then this, along with discussions with the operators about their plans of development for future wells and considering other public and private information, was then summed on a per-field basis produce the forecast you see here. After generating the 2009 fall forecast, comparing it with previous forecasts, this forecast, I think, is a bit more conservative than prior years. In addition, there were several areas that we did not include in the forecast as either under development or under evaluation criteria, and that were areas such as ANWR, NPRA, and some heavy oil deposits. Also not included, but worthy of consideration in the future, was a recent public statement by Renaissance Alaska LLC about the Umiat field with an estimated 1 billion barrels of oil in place and a probable recovery in the order of 200 million barrels. Can we go on to the next slide, please? Okay, I'm assuming you're looking at the next slide now. And this depicts just the forecast section of the production. What you're looking at there, the gray part towards the bottom, is a projection from currently producing wells. Our confidence in this is pretty high. I would expect that we would probably get within plus or minus 3% of the actual numbers in the forecast 1 or 2 years out. The rainbow of colors you see above the gray section there would be production projected from projects that are either under development or under evaluation. Our confidence in these, the numbers, our confidence in the forecast numbers in these is not quite as good, but I would guess anywhere between 10 and 15, plus or minus 10 and 15% for the next 1 to 2 years. One note, if you look out there around the year 2022 or 2023 up at the top, there's a big pink bulge out there. That is the projection we have for Point Thompson, and that bulge is contingent upon a gas sales line. So if the gas sales line is not constructed, that bulge would not be there, so the production, the total production, would be quite a bit less.
Could you just clarify NPRA again, please, because on the confusion if it's on or off the data list?
I'm sorry, if it's on or off the what?
Your forecast, your chart here showing NPRA on it, and I thought you mentioned it wasn't used.
You're right. Initially, I said it was not in the forecast. There's some minor production for NPRA here that we do have in this particular forecast under evaluation.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Go ahead and continue.
Yeah, if we go on to the next slide, there's just some statistics about recent production, 2.1 million barrels. And now we're down to about 693,000 barrels. The decline rates on average have been around 5%. And in the future, they're probably going to be somewhat less. But again, near term, they'll probably be about 4.5% to 5%.
So, Mr. Molley, if we look at, you know, an average basin around the world, is this kind of a semi-normal production scheme over the last 20-plus years?
Yes, typically what you'll see in a basin is a decline rate that's, you know, it's going to be fairly steep at the beginning, and then it'll flatten out as the reservoir ages. It'll tend to flatten out, and the decline rate will change with time. So this is a fairly typical oil basin.
So when we look at the comments in the press and elsewhere, that the oil production peaked out at 2 million barrels a day and now it's a little south of 700. That is not because we've had dysfunctional policies in the state that's driven the production down, but this is the natural decline in the oil basin.
Very definitely. That's very typical of any oil basin that you would look at.
Okay, thank you.
Probably wouldn't matter if you spent hundreds of billions of dollars, you're going to hit a natural decline at some point, as you see in your Alaska production.
Yeah, I think that's just an important point for us to remember as we struggle to try to slow the decline down. But if you can go ahead and continue with your presentation, please.
If you're looking at the slide 20, that's basically the last slide. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Okay. Seeing none, then we'll go on to the next presenter. And we'll go into the fall 09 oil price forecast. And
this is Donna. Donna will take the oil price one.
Okay, Ms. Kepler?
Mr. Chair.
Just hold it a second. Senator Huggins.
Yeah. Apologize for the delay there. But Commissioner Galvin, I noticed the reduced by over a full percentage point the rate of decline to 3.6. I'm not sure what the rationale for that is, but let's just say it's correct. Said more positively, we must have a program that is comprehensively and hopefully has some dynamics involved to abate that decline. And we don't need that today, but I would certainly appreciate any information you have on that program that, quote, attacks that decline.
Sure.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. Ms. Keppers, if you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then take us through the price forecast, please.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Donna Keppers, Audit Master for the Department of Revenue. We'll be covering the high points for the price forecast methodology, and we'll start on slide 22. Our price forecast came out of a price forecasting session that we hosted on October 6th, and we had about two dozen economists from throughout state government, as well as industry experts, attend. At the session, we studied factors that influenced price, including supply expectations, demand expectations, the economy, geopolitics, financial markets, and several other factors. And what we did is we asked each of the participants to give us their most likely expectation of future prices, and then we averaged those results to come up with our price forecast. What we did differently this year than last year is, due to the uncertainty about the financial markets, we chose to focus our efforts more on short-term prices for our session. If we could move to slide 23, please. This slide is a graph that shows WTI, which is West Texas Intermediate, price forecasts that were available to us at the time of our session. And WTI is known as Texas Light Sweet, and it's a type of crude oil that's used as a benchmark in oil pricing. And the underlying commodity of the New York Mercantile Exchange is oil future contracts. So what we did, if you look at the chart on 23, you can see that our forecast is the dotted line, and the green one is one of the industry experts, the EIA, what they had forecasted for the short period, and then the NYMEX in the red. For fiscal year 10 and 11, our price forecast came out at 68.71 and 78.85, and are very similar to prices predicted by the NYMEX, the EIA, and the analyst.
And Donna,
if you can hold it a minute.
So,
Senator, or excuse me, Commissioner Galvin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to just highlight a couple things on here for folks just to get their bearings. The EIA is the federal government's forecasting group out of the Department of Energy. As you can see from this slide, they are extremely bullish as a result or with their expectations of oil prices going out over the next few years with the price crashing over $100 somewhere in the next 3 years. The red line represents basically the futures market. So this is where people are actually putting their dollars into an option on oil prices, where they're looking to make some money. So it's generally going to be on the lower end because they're looking for a little bridge if they're going to make some money off of that investment. The blue line is our synthesis of a number of different industry forecasts, where we blend them together as an average, and as you can see as you would expect, kind of cuts the middle between what EIA is projecting and what NYMEX is projecting. And then, as Donna said, the black line represents where our state official revenue forecast now sits, and you can see it's slightly more conservative than the average.
And just for those at home, the production forecast is normally much tighter than the price forecast as far as, you know, the outcomes that we actually see. But the price sensitivity in the budgets overwhelms the volume sensitivity, so we're much more sensitive to a change in price than we are a change in volume. And there's quite a magnitude difference, and we'll get into that another day. But we always, you know, hope that the revenue or the price forecasters will be as accurate as the barrels forecaster, and it'd have to be just about spot on to get it. So we'll see here in a year how close they are.
We'll see. Sorry, Donna. Thank you.
If you can continue, Ms. Keppers.
Thank you, Commissioner Galvin and Mr. Chairman. On slide 24, we've got another table that shows us the oil price forecast for both WTI and ANS that came out of our session. And it takes us all the way to 2015.
If you could just hold it there for a minute. I know the commissioner has a question or comment here, but I'd like you, in some future date, or the commissioner, to get back to us on the issue that seems to be popping up in the press where there's a drifting off of the West Texas Intermediate as a benchmark. There's some issues going on that we haven't talked about at the table here in the state, so we can address that at a future date and what impacts, if any, it may have on the state of Alaska. But Mr. Commissioner.
Yeah, I just wanted to note that, and that's a good segue, and for those at home, we're looking up at the slide. WTI West Texas Intermediate, as Donna mentioned earlier, is a standard benchmark that is used, that is a published index, so you can follow it and track it more easily than you can with our individual spot sales of ANS, stands for Alaska North Slope. So that's the price, basically our West Coast price for the delivery at a refinery. And what we get reported, the sales on individual basis, we might get one, might get two or three a day, but we use the WTI to give us a sense of where the price is at any particular moment. The differential between the two will fluctuate. And we use for our forecasting purposes a $2.50 discount from WTI to get to our Alaska North Slope projection. So when Donna mentioned earlier the forecasting session, we bring the folks together, they project West Texas Intermediate because that's kind of what they can use looking at the world market and so forth, and then we just drag off of that $2.50 to get our ANS. In reality, ANS will swing from somewhere closer to West Texas Intermediate, sometimes at a premium. And in fact, recently we've seen more premium sales over West Texas Intermediate, and I think that's probably what cues the chairman's question about whether West Texas Intermediate still provides the same level of index to our ANS price or not, and we can talk about that in a future session.
All right, okay, thank you. You have a question, Senator Egan?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Commissioner, there's been a lot of discussion about the emerging technologies of developing and producing heavy oil. Are you taking that into consideration when you compare West Texas versus ANS?
We are in some sense. The heavy oil is going to result in two different changes, and I'll let the economist also comment on this. On the one hand, on the upstream side, it's going to cost more per barrel to produce. And so there would be an expectation within our production forecast how much with regard to lease expenditures are associated with those, and that's part of what the companies provide us in terms of what their level of expenditure is based upon the type of field that they're developing. The second goes to the issue that I referred to earlier, the quality bank, and maybe I'll have either Dan or maybe Sherry might want to comment on it, is to the extent that we incorporate a quality bank adjustment into our future projections as it relates to heavy oil.
If you could give us just a brief blurb on that, because we'll go into the quality bank later on in detail, because that's an important issue on these adjustments, but maybe just give us a 30-second soundbite on that and we'll move on.
Kick it to Sherry?
Yes.
Okay. Dan. Online, we also have Sherry Niehaus, who is sort of the team lead for a lot of the projection stuff. So I don't know, Sherry, if you're available to comment on that one.
Right. Ms. Niehaus, would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and then help us with the quality bank in a brief definition, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sherry Niehaus. I'm a petroleum economist with the Department of Revenue. As far as the heavy oil goes, yes, it's correct that there are probably additional costs incurred in order to produce the heavy oil. As far as the value of the heavy oil when it is marketed, and also with respect to the quality bank, generally speaking, heavy oil would be discounted because of the components of the heavy oil are just simply not worth as much in a refinery as a light sweet crude would be. So you have the component on the West Coast, and depending on the refinery, whether or not it's set up to accept heavy oil, and if it's not, or it's a, an additional cost for them, then the value of the oil is decreased. Additionally, Commissioner Galvin mentioned the Quality Bank. Quality Bank is generally something that occurs in Alaska when oil is sold to refineries here. Basically, refineries extract the most valuable oil, components of the oil, in order to refine the jet fuel and other products that they make. And so then basically the way the Quality Bank works is whatever they put back into the pipeline generally decreases the quality of the oil as it goes through the pipeline. So that's another aspect of the value of heavy oil. So all those components go into basically at this point in time making heavy oil probably valued less, but you know, this, those things could change as refineries adapt to taking on more heavy oil.
Okay, and then there's another, just a little brief note to, on the question, the large 20% credit that we have embedded in ACES and PPT was targeted to help with the extra cost, and you'll see as we go forward, it's much more expensive to deal with heavy oil, and it's kind of an evolving technology, but we have a lot of it up there, and we'd like to, you know, get it out and get it sold. So, Commissioner Galvin, you want to go ahead and continue here? We have about 7-8 minutes, and we're going to wrap up. So.
Okay. So with that, we'll turn it over to Dan to talk about lease expenditures, and I'll just highlight that as Dan goes through this, just understand that we are gaining a window into the spending profiles of the companies that we hadn't had previously, and that we, through the tax reports that they have to provide us under a net-based tax, we are provided with data that we'll be able to further provide you guys with a better insight into sort of the spending, but it is at its beginnings, its infancy, with regard to being able to truly collate it and pull it into something that we can analyze closely. But Dan is part of a team that is beginning that process and has generated information that, that is a much more refined reflection of spending than what we've had previously.
And Mr. Stickle, before I call on you to introduce yourself and speak to the issue, it's just an added comment on Commissioner Galvin's previous remarks that we've had those similar remarks made to us from our own consultants that have worked in modeling the basin and helping us with our analysis and questions that we may have. And they're a little surprised on the lack of information we've had in this basin. And one of the things that has evolved over PPT and through ACES, you know, that, that is slowly being changed. But so I wouldn't want people to get the impression it's some issue with revenue or DNR. It's a broader issue that's embedded, goes way back in our old structure. And we're working on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the last thing I'll note is just for Dan's benefit, so you guys understand, there are restrictions with regard to how much confidential information, taxpayer information, we can provide. And that requires us to provide such things as this, the lease expenditure information in a very aggregated form rather than on a taxpayer-specific basis. Mm-hmm. And so there may be restrictions on what we can provide in terms of the types of information, but I think what we have now provides a fairly good picture of where things are.
Okay, Mr. Stickle, if you can identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and then speak to lease expenditures on slide 26, please.
Sure. For the record, my name is Dan Stickle. I'm a petroleum economist with the Department of Revenue. First, just a couple words about the data that we do have available to us at the department regarding lease expenditures. We have historical data from fiscal year 2007 through 2009 based on information that's been submitted on the annual returns from the taxpayers and on monthly information forms we receive. We have a slightly longer time period looking just at capital expenditures from information we received under PPT.
Can you pull your mic forward a little bit, please?
Sure. And then As far as historical data, under ACES, we request forecasts from the producers for their estimates of what they're going to spend. And what we get back from them is forecasts of expenditures as well as plans of development for the various projects in the state. And the documentation that we're getting, that we get from the companies, typically gives us a five-year window or so of what they're expecting going forward. So our lease expenditure forecast is based mostly on this information that we're getting from the companies. So it's what are the companies expecting under the current conditions in the state, what are they expecting to spend? And so if you go on to the, just click forward. This is a picture of 3 years of historical lease expenditure data. The operating expenditures are for the North Slope. They're about $2 billion a year. That's been pretty steady for fiscal 07 through fiscal 09. And then also for the next two fiscal years, we're seeing operating expenditures remain fairly steady. Capital expenditures, we do see increasing. They have increased for the last 2 years. We see them going up again in fiscal 10 and again in fiscal 11. And there have been, we are seeing that some companies are reducing their capital expenditures, but we have other companies, new companies coming into the state, as well as new projects coming online that we heard about in the production forecast, and those are more than outweighing those companies that are reducing their expenditures. So we do see capital spending going up for the next 2 years. And the final slide.
If we could just hold that just for a second on that. What we'll do when we look at the capital expenditures, we'll also look at where the revenue to the Treasury comes in, if it's Prudhoe-Kupparuk or outlying fields, or and try to, you know, get a feel for where the capital is flowing and where our revenue source is, and they may not necessarily match. But go ahead and continue.
Sure, and the final slide I have just gives you the raw numbers behind the chart, as well as an illustration of the lease expenditures by operating and capital expenditures on a per barrel basis compared to our production forecast. You see that operating expenditures, that the absolute number has been relatively steady. They are ticking up on a per barrel basis. Capital expenditures, on the other hand, on a per barrel basis, are up very significantly. They've more than doubled for our projection from 2011 compared to fiscal year 07.
And as I recall, and we can go back and check the presentations over the next several weeks, but when we did PPT, I think we were looking at bringing capital expenditures up $1 billion in the basin. And I think that was some of the testimony at that time, so we can go back and pull that out as far as what we were expecting when we put in net profit tax versus the ELF system. And I think that'll be, those were, the testimonies were not only at Senate Finance, but in Resources Committee. And we can see how that's flowed forward. And then also look at our projections of what we thought capital expenditures were doing as a trend, because I think the industry had forecast there was substantial upward pressure on capital expenditures. And this is back about 4 years. And we didn't really recognize that at the table, and we had to come back and revisit the issue because we had some modeling errors. It wasn't the administration, by the way, it was on our side of the table on that one. But go ahead, Commissioner.
I believe that's the end of the, I don't know if you have anything more you want to say to this one, or?
That's the end of the formal presentation.
So, finished on time.
Do we have any other questions for the commissioner? Beginning questions on this layout? I'd like the senators to go ahead and get with me on what expansions they'd like to have in that calculation flow as we build on that model to, so you know, we get a good understanding of what we're dealing with on the table. And I'd like to go ahead and thank the commissioner and his staff support, even though I don't think he needed any staff support to do this presentation. It's nice to give him a break after having him speak for an hour.
I may speak a lot, but the staff is actually what builds all the all the numbers. So
I know they built it, but you can explain it. There's no doubt about it. Tomorrow we're going to have Ms. Karen Rayfield, the budget director for the administration, come forward, present some beginning budget information for us to consider. So we'll see everybody back 9 a.m. Tomorrow morning. Meeting adjourned.